Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Trevor Edels, distinguished author, international authority on mainframes and computing. Trevor, you bring a long history of significant and considerable international contribution to this interview. We are indeed fortunate to have you share your many deep experiences with the audience. Thank you.
You're welcome, Stephen. I feel honored to be invited to take part in your series of interviews, so thank you.
Now, Trevor, can you take a moment to describe your history, current roles, and work?
Well, it was quite a long journey to get here. I started my working life as a teacher, and back in the late 1970s, I went on a training course to learn how to teach the new subject of computing to children. I was then invited to spend 3 weeks with an IT bureau called SciComm. They ran UNIVAC 1100 series mainframes, and at the end of the 3 weeks, they offered me a job, and I took it. While I was at SciComm, they got their first IBM mainframe. I wrote the training documentation for them and much of the simple JCL for operators and ops support to use. Most of the other people there looked on the IBM machine as well outside their comfort zone, which was how I got the opportunity. After that, I joined a company called Protocol, who provided training for IBM mainframe operators and managers, and I left them to work for Zephon in 1986. At Zephon, I chaired and spoke at numerous seminars. I conducted and wrote up many of their surveys on mainframe topics, but mainly I edited the update journals, things like Kix Update, MVS Update, and DB2 Update. I also got heavily involved in making the publications available on the company website. Then, in 2004, the update publications were sold to TCI Publications, the people who do Z Journal. I carried on editing them until 2007, but working for my own company, iTechEd Limited. I've also written lots of articles and white papers. I've run training courses. I'm qualified to teach about Microsoft Office products, and I've designed and coded a number of websites for different organizations. In fact, I've got an article due to appear in the October-November issue of Z Journal on IMS and cloud computing, which I'm just finishing off now. I blog every week, which I find keeps me up to date with computing trends. I'm a gold blogger at IT Toolbox, and I was a finalist in the category Individual IT Professional Male in Computer Weekly's IT Blog Awards last year. I've recently completed a week's training on Microsoft SharePoint, and I was made an IBM Information Champion in 2009 and again in 2010. And I'm a qualified hypnotherapist, and more recently I've qualified to use cognitive behavioral therapy with clients. So my life isn't all IT.
So, I just find that interesting, the cognitive behavioral therapy part. That's amazing.
It's very interesting. I mean, it really, really does give you an insight into how people think, and perhaps more importantly, how people think wrongly. And, you know, because of that insight, you can help them. So, I found it very, very, very useful, very enjoyable.
Now, Trevor, can you talk about the Arcadi Mainframe Yearbook and its value to mainframe professionals?
Okay, well, the Arcadi Mainframe Yearbook started life in 2005 as a project by Mark Lillicrop, who I think you may know from the Zephon days. Anyway, it's in so many ways the de facto reference work for IT professionals working with ZOS systems. It includes an annual user survey, an up-to-date directory of vendors and consultants, a media guide, a strategy section with papers on mainframe trends and directions, and a glossary of terminology, and finally a technical specification section. The yearbook is available free in PDF format on the Arcadi website, and each year it gets between 10,000 and 15,000 downloads. What makes it so useful is that readers can look up almost any information they need in the yearbook, vendors or consultants. And the glossary is always well received. In the media section, we used to focus on printed mainframe information, but nowadays we tend to focus more on mainframe bloggers, although of course there are still printed journals available. I originally produced the glossary of terminology, but for the last 3 years I've edited the whole thing, with expert input from Mark, of course. If it's free to users, then who pays for our time, I hear you ask? Well, the answer to that is we allow vendors to advertise in the yearbook. We also have people sponsoring it, which allows them to contribute white papers for the strategy section. There are also strategy articles from other sources in this section, but the part that many people are especially interested in is the user survey. We get close to 100 mainframe users complete the survey each year, and from that, from what they say, we can identify trends in mainframe computing. So that way readers can also compare their site with similarly sized sites and see how they compare with what they're doing to the statistical average. Users can download the yearbook and read it on their smartphone or laptop, and they could even print it out if they wished. The yearbook is always popular with the mainframe community at large, which is shown by the high number of downloads we get.
So what are the benefits of joining the virtual IMS Connection user group?
Okay, well, that's similar to the yearbook. The focus of the virtual IMS Connection user group and the website is to share information with busy professionals. The user group was established as a way for individuals using IBM's IMS hierarchical database and transaction processing system to exchange information, to learn new techniques, and advance their skills of the product. The user group has webinars every other month, and we have a fairly technical presentation as the main part of that meeting. The website contains a list of IMS-related software and IMS consultants, so it's easy for IMS professionals to get the information they need. We also include a summary of any product launches or upgrades in the news section, and we list any new IMS-related articles that are published anywhere on the web. We don't run a listserv ourselves, but we do link to BMC's IMS listserv. Any IMS professional is welcome to join. It's free, and they get access to the information and the free webinars. And by having virtual meetings, they don't have to face the hard task of convincing their company to fund their user group experience. And, can I add, there are also advertising opportunities available for vendors on the website.
Now, earlier, when I was asking you about your history and your current roles and so forth, you talked about looking at SharePoint. Can you tell me what you see as some of the benefits of SharePoint?
Oh, gosh, SharePoint. I mean, I was trained on SharePoint 2010, which has only just come out, and that's sort of version 4 of SharePoint as far as Microsoft are concerned. And as you know, as we all know, you probably need to get to at least version 3 of a Microsoft product before it's sort of really good. And version 4 is very good. What it does is it kind of takes over the working of the whole of your organization. I guess many people would think of SharePoint as a way of introducing simply an intranet. But because of the collaboration that's built into it, you know, you can share documents. That is an absolute major part of it. It makes life very easy. It's a way of changing the way people work in an organization and do it in a much more controlled way. As well as the collaboration, the other really key thing, I think, is workflow. That is absolutely built into the latest version of SharePoint, which means that you can control what happens with documents. So, for example, I might write a draft of a policy, maybe, and then I need to send it to my manager for him to look at. You can actually build that into the workflow, and then when he's looked at it, it then gets sent to perhaps two other people. That, again, can all be built into the workflow, and finally it comes back to me. Any changes can be made, and it can be sort of shared at the next team meeting or whatever it is. So those kind of two things, the workflow, the collaborative working, means that sort of SharePoint 2010 comes as almost a complete way of taking over the way your company works. It is very, very clever. I do wonder, though, whether many sites are going to realise, you know, the full potential of it. But, no, having been on the course, I'm a bit of a fan.
I see, and, you know, companies are very much enabling individual profiles and wikis and blogs and the myriad of ways that people can do document control, and all of those things, I guess, are inherent or part of this platform, and the ability to maybe be a repository of videos and podcasts and so much more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got the My sites where you can store lots of things for yourself, but you've got the Team sites where you can set them up for sharing. But, yeah, on top of that, sort of blogging and wikis are an integral part of SharePoint. So, you know, it's bang up to date. And the other big thing with 2010 is that previously you've always really needed to use Explorer to... you know, use it properly. But with this version, Microsoft's recognised that there's an awful lot of people out there who like to use Firefox, and that's built into it, that you can use alternative browsers to make it work. And, you know, it does. It's put together very nicely.
And I guess that would be one of your competencies now, helping people with their SharePoint implementations.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, like I say, I was impressed with the material on the course. It was very thorough, and I was very impressed with the software itself. You know, Microsoft, well done.
Now, can you share your top predictions for the future and why we should pay attention?
Okay, well, first of all, there's hardware improvements. And that's perhaps an obvious one because, you know, mainframes particularly are hardware, and we can see that there are lots of exciting things going on there. Since the first mainframes were released, there's been a continual improvement in the speed and a reduction in the size of what's available. But now what we've seen is not only a reduction in the footprint, we're actually seeing a huge reduction in the greenhouse effect associated with mainframes and sort of peripheral devices. And I think that's very important going into the future. And also in the past few years, we've seen the introduction of specialty engines, things like IFL for Linux and ZAP for Java and ZIP for DB2. And what they're able to do is to take the workload off the sort of central processor and run them in these specialty processors. And the advantage of that is that most sites are actually charged for the work done on the central processor. But I think we're going to see a huge growth in the use of these specialty processors. The other exciting thing about hardware is the System Z version 11, the Z11 processor. All the talk suggests that it's going to be with us in September this year. And one of the things that's interesting about the Z11, in a sort of back-to-the-future kind of way, is that we know at least some of the machines will be water-cooled, so it'll be just like the good old days. Secondly, then, there are enhancements to software. CA, for example, as part of its Web2 strategy, enhanced most of its mainframe software line last year. And that's an ongoing thing with other players in this space continuing to upgrade their software. Neon Enterprise Software launched its Z Prime software last year, and Z Prime works by automatically identifying IMS, DB2, KIX, TSO, ISPF, and batch workloads that can be processed on specialty processors, reducing processing costs and improving throughput for the primary CPU. Well, that's what the company's claiming. Of course, they're now involved in cross-litigation with IBM about this. But DataDirect, that's got its Shadow Suite, which takes a broadly similar diversionary approach to handling web integration services, SOA support, and data integration processing. And still with software, you've got lots of things making the mainframe easier to use, particularly in the light of an aging population of IT practitioners with mainframe skills. Many vendors, including IBM, are including autonomics in their software. Now, autonomics means that the software will try to identify potential problems and then fix them. In the old days, if a software couldn't do the job, then it just fell over and everything stopped. Nowadays, you've got intelligence built into the software, which means that it can identify potential problems and actually avoid them or fix them. And finally, the other exciting thing that we're just starting to begin to see is for end users, and that's the interface they're using on the mainframe, is getting more and more Windows-like. And that means that if they're sort of sitting down trying to use a software development kit, they don't need to actually code in the old-fashioned way. They can use the icons on the screen to kind of drag and drop and create programs. So they're just using simple drag and drop techniques, and at the end of the day, the software they're using will create an actual program for them. And the reason this is important is that there's an estimated 60% of company data still sitting on mainframes, and a lot of that data is actually being accessed using old programs. So what we need is some way of being able to get people to create new programs that can get to that data and make it available in new ways. Going on to my third prediction then, it's about training. Many people have suggested that mainframers are getting old and organizations won't be able to replace their staff. Well, the good news is that both IBM and CA in particular are taking a lead in making sure this doesn't happen. IBM has got its academic initiative, which was first introduced, I think, back in 2004. And this runs at universities in the USA, UK and Europe, and possibly elsewhere. And this is where people who are at university can actually get access to mainframe time and do mainframe modules as part of their degree course, which means that there's now a group of youngsters who are familiar with mainframes and are available to get jobs with organizations using mainframes. Similar to that, CA has got a project, and I was recently over in the Czech Republic in Prague and speaking to some of the people that they brought into their project. So this brings mainframe programming down to the university level. It means that not only is there a new group of people going to work for the large software vendors, but also people who can go out and get jobs with organizations that are still running mainframes. And that's something that I'm expecting to see grow, that other large companies will be doing something like that to encourage youngsters to come into the mainframe world. My fourth prediction then concerns the role of the mainframe. Any survey of current usage will confirm that the mainframe has any number of roles in most organizations. It's still satisfying roles it acquired 20 or even 30 years ago, and it's also adopting new ones. So, for example, you've got service-oriented architecture, SOA. This is growing in importance, allowing the mainframe to be a web service consumer as well as a web service provider to internet-based users. There's also much speculation about the role of mainframes in the emerging cloud computing market. More recently, there's been a growth in the use of mainframes in business intelligence solutions, particularly with IBM's $1.2 billion acquisition last July of data mining and statistical analysis software specialist SPSS. IBM says that it intends to integrate SPSS within its information management software portfolio. But as I say, expect to see mainframes as an important part of cloud computing. Moving on to my fifth area then, the thing that is very important to the future of the mainframe is the general public's attitude. I don't know if you remember back in 1991, Stuart Alsop, who was the InfoWorld editor-in-chief, announced that the last mainframe would be unplugged in 1996. Well, there's still a lot of people who hold that view, maybe not 1996, but they still think the mainframes are being phased out. These are people I like to think of as the Windows generation, people who grew up using Windows, and that's what they're expecting. And they're only now discovering all the important things about backups and restores and security and that kind of thing, problems that were solved on the mainframe a long, long time ago. And these people quite often don't understand the success of the mainframe. So although all those other things I've been talking about are the reason it's a very bright future for the mainframe, this is one task for all of us. We've got to go out and encourage this Windows generation to actually see the benefit of using a mainframe. And to be honest, a lot of them are beginning to. I've been to a number of sites that are using things like Citrix, which is a piece of software that allows your Windows user to get some of the kinds of benefits that you often associate with mainframes. So my final prediction then is that unless we bang the drum about mainframe successes, we're going to find that less well-informed decision makers will choose to use other computing platforms instead.
So how will organizations use cloud computing, and why should computing professionals care? And then what is the role of mainframes in cloud computing?
Okay, cloud computing then is internet-based computing in which shared resources, software, and information are provided to computers and other devices on demand. Providers of cloud services try to, one, enable economies of scale, supporting large volumes of users at increasingly lower cost; two, create an affordable and available supply of virtualized assets; three, maintain a green footprint in the face of energy regulations and constraints; four, meet service level agreements; and five, secure the cloud, protecting user privacy and integrity within shared system services. And computer professionals should care because consumers are demanding this kind of environment. Computing is shopping, where you just take and pay for what you want and don't really worry about anything behind the scenes. Microsoft is making a song and dance about its Office web apps and Facebook integration. And Google is working with VMware to develop a new operating system for the cloud. Microsoft's got its Windows Azure, which is an environment for developing service hosting and service management based on the cloud. It's designed to allow developers to compute, host, scale, store, and also manage the web apps they create. But why should mainframers care? Well, luckily, IBM mainframes satisfy the criteria for cloud computing. A mainframe is a trusted repository for highly secure information and an open platform supporting anything from Web 2 agile development environments with RESTful interfaces to enterprise-class middleware. Mainframes are resilient and able to meet customer SLAs. In terms of scalability, a systems complex, or SysPlex, allows multiple processors to be joined into a single unit to become a single logical system running on one or more physical systems. IBM mainframes also make use of a scalable clustering technology called Parallel SysPlex, which provides a hugely horizontally scalable architecture, allowing multiple systems to execute jobs in parallel. And if that isn't enough, then there's geographically dispersed Parallel SysPlex, GDPS, which takes the concept behind Parallel SysPlex and makes it work across sites that can be some distance apart. In terms of security, any data in one partition cannot be read by anything running in a different partition. System Z even has an encryption coprocessor, the Crypto Express 2, as well as system-level facilities for encrypting data sets. And mainframes also have security software, such as IBM's RACF and CA's Top Secret and ACF2. I mean, RACF, for example, supports security features such as digital certificates and public key infrastructure services, which makes it perfectly suited for cloud computing. And lastly, the mainframe's virtualization capabilities are so well recognized that I don't need to go into them here. I really don't need to say things like ZVM or Prism. And of course, IBM is embracing cloud computing. It's developed the world's largest private smart analytics cloud computing platform, codenamed Blue Insight, which combines the resources of more than 100 separate systems to create one large centralized repository of business analytics, according to IBM. Also, IBM has announced a program designed to help educators and students pursue cloud computing initiatives and better take advantage of collaboration technology in their studies. They're calling it the IBM Cloud Academy. IBM provides the cloud-based infrastructure for the program, along with some simple collaboration tools.
Now, do technical blogs help get the message out there, you know, sort of the greater public, or do they just confuse readers?
As a blogger, am I really going to suggest that people reading blogs are going to get confused or even worse, misled? Well, yes. The blogosphere is full of conflicting and confusing information. I mean, firstly, let's turn our attention to the gee whiz gadget at the moment, the Apple iPad. So here's the question we may have all asked ourselves. Do I want an iPad? Well, to help make up my mind, I started searching the internet for articles and blogs. And the first thing you find is that opinions are divided. Numerous bloggers were totally sold on the gadget and can't wait to get their hands on one. While other blogs list the iPad's faults. No multitasking, no camera, awkward keypad, a keyboard, no flash, not HD, and locked into Apple apps, etc. So for someone who doesn't really understand, how do they make a choice? I mean, let's look at mainframes and see what people are blogging about mainframe futures. Well, we've got people convinced that the IBM Z11 processor is the route to nirvana, and other people suggesting that unless we migrate all our applications onto Microsoft boxes, our data centers will come crashing down around our ears. There are blogs extolling the virtue of cloud computing to finally make the end-user computing experience like shopping. And there are other blogs suggesting that using a mainframe has many of the characteristics of cloud computing, and we've been doing it for 40-odd years already. I'm sure I could do exactly the same thing with car models. Some writers would extol their virtues, while others would focus on the vices of the vehicle. Or I could use the internet to try to make a choice about a washing machine, a fridge, a university, anything. The problem is simple. The more egalitarian the internet has become, the more people are happy to share their opinions or repeat the opinions of others. And the consequence of more people giving an opinion is there are more opinions to read, and so more confusion amongst the browsing population. So what's the solution, I hear you ask? Well, the answer is to rely on the opinions of people you trust. For mainframe information, there are a few bloggers that I know what they're talking about, including, hopefully, me. But if I wanted to buy an iPad or a car or whatever, I'm like everyone else. I need to find a trusted expert in the blogosphere. Otherwise, all is chaos.
That's interesting, this whole idea of trusted sources.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very difficult to find that. If you don't know what you're talking about, you're looking for expertise. There's just so much around. I mean, how do you know that one person's view is better informed than anyone else's? I mean, it's the same as going down the pub and talking to people at the bar. You know, you don't know whether that man really knows what he's talking about or he's just making it up as he goes along.
I guess that's the advantage of having some kind of profiles of the bloggers in terms of their background, experiences, citations, and so on.
I think so. I mean, the problem is that most people just go to Google searching for whatever it is, you know, an iPad or a car, and they just look at what's on the first page, and you just read it sort of without perhaps checking that background, you know, and making sure that the person talking does really know what they're saying.
I guess that speaks to this interview, because your background and profile is published with the interview, so people know what you do.
Yes. Well, that's good.
Now, what specific innovations amaze you?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. I was having a conversation along similar lines with someone the other day. We were discussing the enhanced reality on an iPhone, where you hold the phone up, and as you move it around, nearby restaurants in that particular direction are indicated. We said how clever it was. We said how useful it could be. But neither of us said, wow. And that's the point I'm making. We're all getting so used to amazing things that we're not wowed anymore. The very fact the iPhone is so easy to use was a wow factor when it was first launched. But now we just expect all phones to be that easy. And when they're not, we're disappointed. And it's the same with films. When Abyss came out in 1989, we thought, wow, special effects can't get any better than this. And yet we all watched Avatar and thought, yeah, okay. It just seems harder and harder to get that wow factor, to actually amaze anyone. The trouble is, anything that we have, we just take for granted, and we're looking forward to the next big thing. Yet when it comes, yeah, we're not that impressed. So anyway, with that caveat, I've got three innovations that really impressed me. And the first one is geostationary satellites, because they really do allow global communications. The fact that we've got them has been a great leap forward in being able to communicate. My second one is the Human Genome Project. I mean, understanding how humans are built is absolutely the baseline for all sorts of future scientific advances. And my third one, then, is the fairly prosaic electric light bulb, but without which so much of everyday life would be completely different. And if you need a fourth, I guess I'm not sure where we would be without the invention of the wheel.
Well, that's interesting, because it's sort of from an historical perspective. Are there any specific, and I know you talked about this already, that, you know, we're just sort of inundated with so much that we maybe get a little bit, things just don't stand out like they used to. But is there some gadget that you think, wow, like within the past year or is going to come out in the coming year?
Well, I mean, I think sort of like the laptop was the great leap forward, probably 10, 15 years ago, where we suddenly had that whole lot of computing power on our desktop. And then the fact we had the internet, so we could suddenly get on, you know, we could get hold of any piece of information we wanted just by searching. And now I guess the sort of the closest thing to a wow gadget is the iPhone and all those Android phones that are trying ever so hard to be very much like it, because they've made using your phone so simple that your granny could use it. They contain so many features. There's so much you can do. I mean, you can hold up an iPhone and you can record, you know, a 20-minute presentation, assuming your arm doesn't ache too much, and you can immediately upload that to YouTube. You know, there's just so many facilities and features on it and useful things that you can do. You only need to have kind of one lump, and then rather than a laptop, which you needed to, you know, carry around with you in a case, and then the internet where you needed some way of connecting to it, you've just got this very small footprint gadget that you can just pop in your pocket and do so much. So I guess my current sort of top wow thing is the iPhone, or like I say, any of the Android phones that are emulating what it can do and perhaps even adding more features to it.
Yeah, and I guess I would add to that the Windows Phone 7 when it comes out. So
yeah, it'd be interesting to see what that can do.
You know, you're talking about wow, and I was just looking at this video recently of this product called Project Natal, and it's going to be called, I guess, Connect now. It's going to be released in November of this year, and, you know, it's targeted for the gaming environment, but I'm thinking, God, there could be so many applications in the educational environment and the corporate communications environment, you know, because it's all with, you know, you don't have to carry anything with you to communicate with other people or to interact with them. It actually senses you, and it creates an avatar of you in the screen, and it has voice recognition. And I'm thinking that sometime that's going to be, you know, that's going to be in your phone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. I mean, I think that there was a lot of clever stuff went on with, like, the development of the Wii and then the Xbox and all that kind of thing. And we're going to see those kind of developments just coming back into sort of more mainstream computing. And the most exciting bit of mainstream computing at the moment is on the phone, isn't it? It's that incredible form factor. You're working on something so small and you can do so much with it.
Well, with the mobile phone, basically everybody has supercomputing in their pocket.
Oh, yes. I mean, I can remember when sort of the very large IBM mainframe that I was working on had less computing power than, you know, my old phone had.
Now, you know, because of all the kinds of work that you do and in your travels and so forth, do you have any stories that you can share from your work? Maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing or humorous?
Well, yes, unfortunately, not a lot of the work I do is particularly funny, but a couple of things I thought of. I did have one speaker at a webinar who used the picture of a very young film star on slides while he was describing himself, which was quite funny. And because it's a webinar, no one could see him, so they just looked at the picture of the youthful star and associated it with his voice, which I thought it was quite nice. I mean, it was tongue-in-cheek, but nicely humorous. Yes, personally, I did once turn up for a presentation in the Netherlands without any slides. Luckily, I had sent a short article summarising my presentation ahead of time, but I flew into Schiphol Airport armed with my presentation, and I think I even got it out of my bag at the hotel the night before. But that's where I went wrong. That's the last time I can remember seeing it, because I think I put it down somewhere in the hotel room and never picked it up. And so as a consequence, there I was, standing in front of 50 or so people, trying to give a presentation with absolutely nothing for them to look at, except my frantic arm waving. In the end, it seemed to go down okay. But you can imagine how I felt standing there in front of all those people without any slides. It was a hugely embarrassing moment, and maybe they thought it was funny at the time. Other than that, I guess I'm always really pleasantly surprised, always really pleased at just how helpful people can be. I mean, I quite often go out to sites and talk to people, and I find that people are always very, very nice. And, you know, the kind of media presentation of people is always that people are very selfish and self-serving. And in fact, I've not found that to be true, and I find that very pleasing.
Now, what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like medicine, law, accounting, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, recognized credentials, and more?
Well, I would support wholeheartedly the professionalization of computing. I mean, naming no names, but I've come across lots of IT personnel who have an incredibly limited knowledge of the choices available or the types of technique that can be used to make things happen. I worked with someone many years ago who reckoned he could do anything on a computer with a few lines of code, and he was a great hit with customers. They liked dealing with him. He wrote assembler, and he made things happen. But so often these days, particularly with Windows support staff, the answer always seems to be no. You know, a particular change can't be made. And that's either because it's too much effort or because they really don't know enough. So I think things like ITIL, you know, the IT infrastructure library, which provides best practice examples for service management, and IP3 are all about setting standards for the IT industry. And I think organizations like that should be supported. I also think they should have some way of including in the membership recognized industry professionals who've been around the block a few times and should incorporate their skills and best practice. At the moment, from a customer's perspective, when you employ a consultant or an organization to work on your IT with you, you have no way of knowing how good they are or what standards they achieve compared to other similar organizations. You don't even know what sort of standards they aspire to. So yes, I would absolutely support computing becoming a recognized profession with continuous professional development, a code of ethics, and of course letters after your name so customers know that you adhere to their standards.
Now, if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Okay, I'd ask, what are HTML5 and CSS3, and why are they important? And I'd answer that by saying, rule number one of the internet is, of course, that there are no rules. But if there were, it would be that the internet is always changing and evolving. And now we have CS3 and HTML5. Many currently available browsers allow the clever new stuff in CSS3 and HTML5 to work already. Opera and Safari provide support. Firefox from version 3.5 supports HTML5. And Explorer version 8 does a bit. And the proposed version 9 will do more. CSS3 is simply the next generation of style sheets, and it offers loads of clever stuff. The most exciting one, certainly for those of us who've developed websites using multiple images to achieve the same effect, is rounded corners. you can now have boxes with varying roundnesses of corners, except in Explorer, where they're still square. You can specify a radius value, and that affects how round the corners are. And so it also now becomes very easy to use borders. The downside at the moment is that you need to code everything three times. Each piece of code needs to be repeated. So you use Moz for people on Mozilla browsers, like Firefox, and WebKit for Safari and Chrome users, and a straightforward tag like box shadow for those browsers that already support the CSS3 standards. There are also tags beginning with the word Microsoft, and there's one really good one. Microsoft gives us the rather nice word wrap tag, which I like. There are lots of other clever CSS3 tricks in development too. You can create drop shadows, do impressively clever things with gradients, and make text become more transparent as you mouse over it. HTML5, as well as potentially making Flash and Silverlight come to that redundant, provides a way to make web applications more easily available. It's much more than a simple markup syntax for documents. HTML5 now contains tags for things like navigation, which is nav, headers, footers, articles, and sections. Yes, Explorer is the only fly in the ointment, as it were, which will come as a surprise to no one. Explorer needs you to run a bit of JavaScript in order for the code to, or the CSS3 to actually style the page. HTML5 has video and audio APIs. There's drag and drop API with a draggable attribute. There's history.pushDate, which can be used with Ajax apps to give better back button support. There's also a 2D drawing API for scripting graphics using the new canvas element. In fact, there are loads of new good stuff, and there's more being added all the time. And did I mention the geolocation API? It's brilliant. So HTML5 and CSS3 definitely help evolve the internet. So yes, my second question then, is social media a business tool? And I'd answer that by saying, social networks started off being ways to stay in contact with friends or make new friends. It also provided an easy way to share photos and therefore keep up with the activities of those friends that you see less often. You can still do that, but nowadays social networks are becoming business tools, and many organizations are already using them in that way. Intel, at the end of 2008, produced its social media guidelines and encouraged employees to use social media to get the corporate message out to as many people as possible. So if you're not doing it already, what should you be doing? Well, first of all, there's Twitter. Twitter was known only to a few people 18 months ago, but today it's as well known as any other social media website. As you probably know, Twitter is a micro-blogging site allowing 140-digit messages to be sent. You have to publicise that you're on Twitter so that people will follow you, and that means read your tweets. You can tweet that you're just enjoying a cup of coffee or whatever, but for business, you probably want to tweet a news headline or an appointment date and time, like the next webinar or a conference. You then put a semicolon and a URL where people can go to read more details. If you have a series of tweets on the same topic, you can use hashtags, which just means putting a hash in front of a word that's found in each tweet. And people can now retweet, which means they can pass on your tweets to their friends, extending the number of people who see your message. You can use a Twitter widget so that your tweets appear on your web page, and that way people who browse your website can see the latest information you're sharing. And you can use other software like TweetDeck to see whether anyone else is tweeting about your company. And if you're interested, you can find my tweets at twitter.com/T_Eddles. One related thing to Twitter, it's often a good idea to shorten those linking URLs because they can get quite long. So you've got to make sure that fits into your 140-character limit. And there's lots of ways to do that. There are places on the web, Bitly and TinyURL will do that for you. They'll take your long web address and turn it into a nice short one. Facebook is also very useful for businesses. It's easy to set up. Produce your own fan page. And I would recommend that you set up a new account so that anyone who becomes your business friend doesn't get access to pictures of you falling down drunk or whatever you've got on your ordinary friends page. Once you set up a company name area on Facebook, anyone can become a fan. It also gives you the opportunity to post photos and meeting dates and events. You can also post information about your company and publish press releases and use the wall to tie everything together. If you find people are putting negative comments, then you'll need to add positive ones so that the bad ones disappear out of sight further down the page. And Facebook can be linked to Twitter. If you want to see a good example of how this can be done, look for Marmite. I also include the Facebook widget on my homepage as a second way of giving people up-to-date information. And you can become a fan of iTechEd at facebook.com/iTechED-Limited/20173674804. In addition, you can have a presence on LinkedIn, eCademy, FastPitch, Plaxo, ZoomInfo, Names, and a host of other communities. And get out there and blog. There are a few big blogging sites available, like Blogger, TypePad and WordPress, and numerous others. Blogs can be used as a way of chatting about an event or news item. It shows a friendly face for interacting with clients, and perhaps more importantly, potential clients. You should always Twitter a link to your blogs and put them on your corporate Facebook page. You can also make your news stories available through an RSS feed. You hope that your fans will be monitoring changes on your website, and you can do the same thing with rival organizations by using a feed aggregator. For example, Google Reader lets you subscribe to your favorite websites, so new content comes to you when it's posted. Google Reader keeps track of which things you've read so that you only see unread items when you come back. If there's a dark blue border around an item, Reader is marking that item as read. Another thing to be thought about is sharing photos or video content. If you have content that could be shared with a wider audience, you can put it on sites like YouTube, Flickr, SlideShare and others. You might ask about MySpace. It gives you the opportunity to create a website and listen to music. But I find if you already have a website, then there's not really a lot of advantage in having that extra web presence with MySpace. Social bookmarking is very interesting. It's a mechanism that allows people to share, organize, search, and manage bookmarks of web resources. Users save links to web pages that they want to remember and or share. Many social bookmarking services provide web feeds for their lists of bookmarks, including lists organized by tags. This allows subscribers to become aware of new bookmarks as they're saved, shared, and tagged by other users. Examples of these include Delicious, Dig, Reddit, and StumbleUpon. But there are lots of others, with new ones arriving all the time. It's a good idea to put links to these on news pages or blog pages, but they can go anywhere. While making sure that staff adhere to guidelines, I would recommend that any organization raises its profile and gets into social media. Well, that is until the next big thing comes along. Okay, my third question then would be, what do you see as the role of openmainframe.org? The openmainframe.org website explains that openmainframe.org is a forum for exchanging news, views, and information related to creating an open market for IBM-compatible mainframe solutions, and I guess that they would put the stress on the word compatible. It goes on to explain that the website was built by a community of individuals and companies sharing a common interest in promoting a fair, open, and diverse marketplace for mainframe solutions. There's a big thank you to T3 Technologies, which describes itself as effectively out of business due to the direct action of IBM. You may remember its T-Server mainframe that was based on the FlexES. That was a great success. Other members include Microsoft, who are clearly not big fans of IBM, the Computer and Communications Industry Association, and CCIA says it promotes open markets, open systems, open networks, and full, fair, and open competition. There's Peerstone Research, which advises customers on buying decisions, and Turbo Hercules, which describes itself as the first commercial entity exclusively dedicated to Hercules, the well-known open-source software implementation of the IBM mainframe architecture. And there are others. This group of IBM alternativists informs us that it believes IT customers can benefit from lower costs, increased innovation, broader choice, and better customer service when markets are truly open and multiple vendors compete for business. And that's a sentiment that it's hard to disagree with, unless I suppose you're an IBM accountant or an Apple executive. Open Mainframe Org is all about opening up the mainframe environment and taking power away from IBM. I've got to say that it's a long time since I was at a site with an ARM Dell mainframe or even a Hitachi one. I think it's always useful to have an organization like this to stand up to monolithic organizations like IBM. I think it's just a good way to keep companies like IBM on their toes.
Well, that was really interesting, your additional questions and your answers, and you provided so much insight that would be of considerable use to the audience. Well, we've come to the end of this interview, so Trevor, we will continue to follow your significant contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, you're welcome, and let me thank you very much for this opportunity.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Trevor Edel, distinguished author, international authority on mainframes and computing.